Second case for argument this morning is Karami against Rolintz. Ms. Murphy.
May it please the court. My name's Anne Murphy, and I represent an individual defendant today, Michael Rolintz of the FBI. Your Honor, I hope it's a little easier to identify the issues in this case. The first issue is there appellate jurisdiction? And the second issue is, has the complaint adequately alleged a constitutional violation by Mr. Rolintz? With a
potential third issue, which would actually bypass both of those issues, and I'm puzzled about why the argument is not made. Perhaps you could enlighten me. When I looked at these papers, the thing that immediately came to my mind is absolute immunity rather than qualified immunity. The thing for which Rolintz is being sued is statements made in an affidavit filed with a court. And the Supreme Court held in Briscoe against LaHue that witnesses have absolute immunity for their testimony. And we have since held that that applies to both state testimony in open court and testimony via affidavit. So it looks to me like Rolintz has absolute immunity from this lawsuit. And, of course, if you were arguing absolute immunity, that all the jurisdictional questions that have arisen about is there appellate jurisdiction when all you're asking is the plaintiffs amend their complaint and things go on would not arise. Is there some reason why absolute immunity has not been asserted in this case?
Probably because Mr. Rolintz would have done very better with you as his lawyer than with me. Probably because Mr. Rolintz would have done better with you as his lawyer than me. And it's possible there's an absolute immunity argument out there that we missed, and indeed it sounds very much as though there is. And you're right that if we had argued absolute immunity, and if it's not too late, obviously, then the jurisdictional issue would fall out.
The jurisdictional issue would just vanish.
It would, Your Honor, because it would be a classic qualified immunity. Under the law, he was entitled to
absolute. No, it would be an immunity appeal, but not a qualified immunity appeal.
Well, an absolute immunity appeal.
But, of course, you never raised it until this minute when Judge Easterbrook was asking you about it. And the district court never even ruled on the qualified immunity point. So that's one of my questions. Now, I suppose, you know, one could imagine, you know, some of these things are questions of law, but how come you didn't get a ruling from the district court? He just said it was premature to decide on qualified immunity, and we have a long line of cases that suggest that before a decision not to rule converts into a denial, certain things have to happen.
Irreparable injury, for example.
For example, yes.
Switzerland cheese and all of that.
It's our position, as you know, Your Honor, and I understand from your briefing order that there may be some doubt about this, that it's a denial of immunity when the court allows the claim to proceed.
How can that be?
Just think. I was about to ask the same question, too. Imagine that the plaintiff had requested a preliminary injunction, and there's a statute saying you can take an interlocutory appeal from the denial of a preliminary injunction. And the district judge says, I'm not ready to rule on your request for a preliminary injunction. I need more information. Is that an order from which the party can appeal on the ground that it is a denial of a preliminary injunction? The established law is no. Unless there's irreparable harm to the conduct of the case or the party, a postponement is not a denial, and you cannot appeal. And as I understood my colleague's question, that was that question.
But, Your Honor, from the qualified immunity point of view, once the court has said, I mean, the point is in your preliminary injunction case, you anticipate that more things are going to happen.
But what if the judge just says, as actually it seemed to me Judge Zagel was saying, that a little bit more development needed to happen so that he could think about the case? For all I know, you would have thought of the absolute immunity argument, but... But you can't really say that it's a denial of the qualified immunity request if the judge doesn't, within 60 seconds of your making the request, grant it.
Your Honor,
judges need some time to think, and some qualified immunity issues are more complex to think through than others, and you just zipped off and took this appeal when he said it was premature.
Because at that procedural point on the motion to dismiss, that was the final answer.
Well, I don't see that that's at all likely. And I also would like to know if you think that there is an absolute right to appeal under the Barron's line of cases, under the qualified immunity appeal line of cases, every time a district court denies a 12b6 motion. Because, of course, usually the denial of a 12b6 motion isn't appealable unless somebody goes through the 1292b process. But I don't see any 12b6 denial that wouldn't immediately be appealable by a public official.
Your Honor, I don't want to argue that for the entire category of cases. No, I think I need to answer it for this case.
You have to argue that.
If it fits within the requirements of Barron's, it has to deny qualified immunity. And Your Honor, on the motion to dismiss.
I understand that, but let me explain why that actually is the logic of your position. Because your position has to be that the qualified immunity argument itself under Saussure against Katz has two parts, one of which is, has any constitutional violation been alleged? That's where you plug into Bell Atlantic against Twombly. It's where you plug into the sufficiency of the pleadings. And that means that every single qualified immunity case that fails at the 12b6 level is immediately appealable. Yeah. That has not been the law thus far.
Now, of course, the Supreme Court's probably going to overrule Saussure against Katz real soon. And then the premise of that argument would go... But as long as Saussure against Katz is still with us, it sounds like you're stuck with this argument.
And you're still going to have this Siegert question. There still has to be an allegation of a constitutional violation.
But of course, if Saussure is overruled, maybe we'll just get back to good old-fashioned uncertainty, which won't help you.
unless we come up with absolute immunity arguments that are highly favorable to our clients. But I think that... when you look at the finality aspect of Johnson v. Jones, it's about, is that procedural stage over for your Bivens defendant? And the truth is, once the district court had said 12b6 motion denied, our position is that that was it on the 12b6 for Mr. Rollins, regardless of...
Particularly because the Supreme Court has made it crystal clear that there can be repeated interlocutory appeals from... denials of qualified immunity. Why isn't that the full answer to what you're saying? Judge Zagel wasn't quite ready to rule, so you know maybe you take that appeal, and then a few more pieces of information drift in, you take another appeal, then he denies summary judgment, you take another appeal, assuming you haven't won at some point on this argument, or on the merits. Maybe you'd win on the merits, for all I know.
But, Your Honor, the point of the qualified immunity defense is... to make sure that if the complaint, for example, does not allege a constitutional violation, that the individual defendant, who, let's remember, is being sued in their individual capacity for what they did at work, doesn't go through the discovery process.
But, of course, you know well that almost every qualified immunity appeal that's taken is actually at one or other summary judgment motions. So it is understood for a court to understand its own jurisdiction, for a court to... lay the groundwork for a sensible ruling, there is some process that simply has to be endured.
I understand that, Your Honor.
The alternative, though, is that you're cleverly trying to get the Supreme Court to overrule Barron's against Pelletier and see the foolishness of allowing an infinite number of qualified immunity appeals in a single case.
Your Honor, I'm not going to speculate as to what the Supreme Court might or might not do. But the point is, from our individual defendant's point of view, once the 12b6 motion is denied, that is a final decision, regardless of whether
actually it isn't. Not when it's without prejudice. We regularly reject appeals from denials. Well, certainly a denial of a 12b6.
And grants.
Either way, there often is amendment of the pleadings. You would have liked to have seen this granted, but your opponents have assured us that they would have come back with even more detail And frankly, reading through your briefs, it's very hard for me to see what notice you weren't put on about what this case is about.
Well, Your Honor, it's more about the plausibility prong than the notice prong, I think.
What's not plausible about this case? You may have absolute immunity, but what's not plausible?
What's not plausible is that when you take all of the facts that, as you say, it's factually somewhat plentiful for a 12b6, it is highly implausible based on the facts in the record that there's an allegation.
There are no facts in the record.
No, there are no facts, but there are plenty of factual allegations, Your Honor, that Mr. Rowlands, who after all to have a plausible showing of entitlement under Rule 8, has to have either had a knowledge of the falsity of the statement in the affidavit or have been so recklessly in disregard of it that it was conscious.
Those arguments have nothing whatever to do with qualified immunity. Those are arguments that the complaint is deficient under Rule 9b.
You're not
entitled to appeal for a 9b reason.
Your Honor, I disagree with that. 9b talks about specificity and the types of things that you have to have in the complaint. But under Twombly, when it was distinguishing...
It also says that intent may be alleged generally.
That's correct.
I might add, you're asking us, using this unfortunate word that Twombly used that we're all dealing with, plausibility, that it's so implausible that a highly placed agent of the FBI might recklessly have failed to take into account information that was being developed in the Chicago office and that was being transmitted to the D.C. office. And I'm afraid that's not one of those things that the court was talking about in Twombly itself.
But you know, if I can just back up a little bit and get to why Twombly, in our view, has really very much changed the playing field here. Your Honor, you're talking about 9b, asking for specific facts. At the end of Twombly, when it's distinguishing Swierkiewicz, it says this is not about pleading specifics. This is about the allegations as a whole being plausible. So what you need there is the allegations that push it over from implausibility into plausibility. And we're talking about a very senior supervisory employee who you know, you have to believe.
And surely you have to do that in the light most favorable to the plaintiff.
You do, Your Honor, but you need a very high level of intent.
Why? No, you don't have to. The court didn't say you needed a high level of plausibility.
Level of intent. Nor did it revoke the part of the rules that says intent may be pleaded generally.
No, it can be pleaded generally, but it has to be pleaded on the basis of specific facts.
And
under
they
Twombly
have specific facts
galore.
They have the affidavit, they have the dates, they have the people who were. I mean, none of this, I think, really gets you too far.
Your Honor, I'm into my rebuttal time, so I'm going to.
Certainly, Ms. Murphy.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Pascal.
Good morning, Your Honors.
I'll start you where I started, Ms. Murphy. You got any way around the fact that this appears to be a slam dunk defense of absolute immunity?
It's a slam dunk loser on absolute immunity, Your Honor, and the district court knew it, and it was presented to the district court. If I may it please the court. I'll start off with this. I obviously, since in your April 4 order, we weren't alerted to this one. I'm taking a quick look at a brief that we happen to have with us, and our main brief on the motion for summary for dismissal on the 12b-6. We anticipated this argument. The government has never bought it. They never answered it. They never raised it on this, and that's why they had every opportunity to raise it here. And we even told them, don't bother. And the reason we told them not to bother.
Would you mind telling us
You
told them? That's my question.
Read the footnote with your permission. Footnote 9 in our brief in the trial court on motion to dismiss on page 31 says, and I quote, "It is noteworthy the defendants do not even attempt to assert a defense of absolute immunity for their submission of the Rowlands Declaration. Government officials who submit sworn statements in support of arrests or searches violate clearly established rights and are not immune from it. C. Malley against Briggs.
Sorry. Absolute immunity applies whether or not the defendant violates clearly established rights. And Malley against Briggs is irrelevant. The Supreme Court distinguished Malley on the ground that that was an ex parte presentation as distinguished from the adversarial presentations involved in Briscoe against LeHue.
Well, would you like me to continue or not, Your Honor? I'll read as little or as much of it as you would like. It does go on for about another two sentences. And we may have gotten lucky. I don't know. But
well,
I
suspect, since no argument of absolute immunity has been made here, that likely what's going to happen is that there's a reasonable chance that this appeal will be dismissed for want of appellate jurisdiction. You'll be back in the district court. Government will then assert the absolute immunity defense. Malley will do you no good whatsoever for the reason I've just given, the reason Malley itself gave for distinguishing Briscoe against LeHue. And what will happen? Is there any reason to think the litigation will not then come to an immediate end?
Absolutely, Your Honor, if I may. I won't read the rest of the footnote. I wasn't prepared to look at the cases we had cited below. I'll be absolutely honest about that. I'm not prepared to brief it against Your Honor, who is obviously steeped in it. But there are facts here that suggest it will definitely continue. And those facts have to do that the audience for this affidavit was not only a court.
Well, it was an immigration judge.
No, Your Honor, not just the immigration judge. The real audience was the district director. And the district director is the official who ultimately freed my client after the record was set straight. So there is no immunity, certainly no absolute immunity for that, Your Honor, and that's why it will continue.
Do you have a malicious prosecution theory?
Malice, do we or does the government?
Your client.
Do we? I believe that we will be able to prove intent. We don't have a malicious prosecution theory that we've articulated for the simple reason that we didn't anticipate the absolute immunity, would not take on a burden we don't need to take on. But we do, I suppose, for example, the reference to malice in some of the cases refers to malice when there's nothing else. But we have not articulated a malice theory unless one considers an intentional or reckless signing of a false affidavit with the information all around the affiant to be malicious. I think it's worth answering other questions Your Honors may have, because I think the case will continue. I do respectfully suggest that there is most definitely a lack of appellate jurisdiction here. What we've gotten essentially from the government is in response to Saussure, which we do cite and which is, for the moment, law of the land. The most remarkable thing, and I think Judge Wood may have been getting to this, about the response of the government to our complaint is that you will search the record in vain for answers to the two questions that Saussure, or for that matter, that Mitchell opposed. They don't ever question don't ever suggest that Mr. Rowlands had a right, an immunity that would allow him to lie deliberately in that affidavit, which was intended to keep my client in jail, and which did so.
Look. Obviously, no one has a right to lie in judicial proceedings. It's the crime of perjury.
Yes, sir.
And the point of cases like Briscoe against LeHue is that if perjury is committed, the right response is a criminal prosecution rather than a private lawsuit. That's the holding of Briscoe. One doesn't have to argue for a right to commit perjury, and there is no such right, to argue that private litigation for damages is not the right response.
But what happened here, Your Honor, is that actually one full month before the Rowlands affidavit, when my client had only been imprisoned wrongfully for a month, my client's lawyer filed an application for his release for bond with the immigration court and, of course, the sound discretion of the district director, who could also have done it. 1 month later, the Rowlands affidavit comes in.
So was that affidavit actually filed both with the district director and the immigration court, or only at the court?
Well, it had to have been the staff. I mean, they're just different staffs of the same entity, Your
well,
Honor.
But I'm just asking a simple question.
The answer is
where
yes.
Where is it mailed? To both?
I can't answer how it was received. We know that it was received because when Mr. Kinnear, Special Agent Kinnear, writes his letter a month later, it's the district director that releases my client, and within 2 days or 2.5 days. So we know he received it. How, again, that's one of the many questions that controlled discovery, which obviously is what Judge Zagel is going to permit if he does, it will be the rule of the case. And so I can't answer the question for sure, but I think there's a strong inference. First of all, the district director, a lawyer named Fritter, who was the lawyer for the director in this matter all along, is shown as having, I think, received the bail motion. So it's hard to believe that the same agency would not have been in Mr. Fritter's hands. Okay. And ultimately, we know how the district director acted in mid-December. So where we're left is, the point where I left off, Your Honors, is the very basic proposition that with all of the paper, three briefs from the government, we never hear an answer to the Saussure questions or to the Mitchell questions, whichever formulation you want to look at. And what we do get, of course, and I won't belabor the point given the comments that Your Honors have already made, are purely legal questions. In fact, I'll read their formulation of the issues. On page 21 to 22 of the brief, purely legal questions of whether the complaint in a Bivens action satisfies federal pleading requirements and whether a plaintiff's allegations state a claim of violation of clearly established law. So what the government has done is to conflate the two with that connector in the middle with a simple and. Purely legal question of whether a complaint in a Bivens action, well, this is not whether the complaint states a cause of action. And I prepared to make that argument at length, but I think it's already been heard by this panel. The simple fact is the government says repeatedly, including their supplemental memorandum that was invited by Your Honors, that they accept the facts as pleaded, and the fact is their briefs belie that notion. If, for example, you look at their original brief, the brief on the merits, you find 42 pages of procedural arguments, pure pleading arguments, and then you get from pages 43 to 47, they get to to show what facts are missing, what needed to be alleged, and what we get from the government in those 5 pages, the only 5 pages where they've actually come close to at least talking about what should be the accepted facts that present this court with a legal question, what we get on that occasion is what I can only call standing Twombly on its head, because what the government argues, and I think Ms. Murphy started to get into this a little bit today, is that what plausibility really meant in Twombly, and this is, for those that might have been confused by it, this is a wonderful opportunity to get even more confused. What Twombly really means is that if the government, that is, if the qualified immunity asserter, the defendant, has a plausible theory, then the plaintiff isn't plausible. And that's basically what those 5 pages do. It's a remarkable argument, and I would think the one thing the court doesn't need in an interlocutory special immunity, qualified immunity appeal, is a whole new way of looking at Twombly that is one of the few that, in its musings on the question, the Supreme Court has not come up with yet. With all due respect, I was going to read very quickly or read excerpts from the complaint, which it seems to us, Your Honor, so clearly and plainly tells Mr. Rollins what he is charged with. I was going to mention 9B, which has been rejected, but Judge Easterbrook beat me to the punch with respect to 9B's requirement that intent need only be alleged generally, and that's a 9B which doesn't even apply, so it's an a fortiori argument. I guess I don't even need to mention I was going to get into Jacobs, this court's view on the inappropriateness of 12B6 motions bringing these issues to the court, but I think that has also been realized and appreciated by Your Honors. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Otherwise, that concludes.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Ms. Murphy?
Yeah, I'd just like to argue a little further towards the point that the question of the sufficiency of the pleadings to state a claim really does go to the qualified immunity question, and it does present a legal issue that should be cognizable on interlocutory appeal. We still do have Saussure. We still have to look first to whether there's a claim of a constitutional violation. And if the complaint doesn't allege a claim, it doesn't allege a claim of a constitutional violation.
If Mr. Karami's complaint had alleged only that certain FBI agents or Mr. Rowlands or anybody else had been rude to him, it seems to me we could look at that and say there's no constitutional right to have polite FBI officials. Rude ones are just part of the bumps of life, and you would get rid of it. But this complaint is nothing like that. This complaint has all sorts of allegations in it that, if taken to be true, suggests some serious problems.
Well, Your Honor, I think our position is that under the, and this may be going to the merits, but that under the plausibility standard, it does fail to state a claim, and that the argument, the generic argument that the complaint fails to state a claim, is a legal question. It denies immunity. So on the appealability issue, that would be our position, that once the district court has denied immunity has denied a 12b6 motion to dismiss, it's a legal question that functionally deprives the defendant of qualified immunity, and it should be appealable at that point.
No, I will comment that the government is often plaintiff in civil litigation as well, and I'm not certain that this idiosyncratic view of plausibility, I suppose in the eyes of the district court judge or in the eyes of the defendant, I don't know whose eyes you're measuring this in, but when the government is plaintiff in a civil action, it might not have such a rigorous view of plausibility.
That's right. Well, I think Twombly says what it says.
Twombly has been cited at this point more than 5,000 times in the courts. I happen to know that because I'm studying it for various reasons.
So, yes,
courts have had a lot to say about Twombly. It uses language. The Supreme Court decided Erickson a couple of weeks later. You know, we all have been trying to understand exactly what's being asked.
Well, it seems that the footnotes are very important, the notion that it doesn't require heightened fact pleading, that it doesn't require probability, but that it does require these additional facts to cross the barrier of what's speculative when there's behavior that's on its face neutral. So, anyway, our position is that if a complaint's denied on that basis, it's a legal ruling that should be appealable in a qualified immunity case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.